This ski report has been brought to you by Roller Chevrolet, 665 Munras in Monterey, home of the Nova and Vega Hatchbacks. I don't know what the weather is. Maeve, how's the weather today? You give the weather report.
You mean the weather outside or the news?
Oh,
the news is hot.
The news
is nice.
Oh, okay.
The weather's not as hot as the news.
Okay.
But it's going to pick up. Things are going to get hotter. Should we go on to Dialogue Conspiracy? Okay, here we go. Every week when we're through with the news, I hope that we'll have a quiet week where we can sit down the following time we get together and discuss academically some of the processes by which conspiracies take place, specifically in the United States, the way that you overthrow a country as large as this and effect a coup d'etat. But each week we have so much news coming in on various methods that I can't stay with one part of the way a government is overthrown. I'm going to jump around to a lot of different subjects today and just cover a lot of things that are in the news, and then you can pick up your papers and follow them from there. This program, for those who haven't listened before, is based upon 10 years of research into political assassinations in the United States and then the murders that followed following the murder of President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. There were hundreds of murders that have followed since that were part of the same systematic overthrow of the electoral process and to keep the power in the hands of a few of the conglomerates. So the news is coming, 1972-73 is a year where we're coming to a peak of power, but the power structure is struggling because it was exposed at the Watergate Hotel, and it's holding on to its position, which is getting whittled away a little bit every week. And I can't say, I really do enjoy, I have to admit that I enjoy to see it all come down. The Watergate will take the news from now on through the next year. I think it'll be the news for years to come in the United States of America. The Watergate stories as they broke this week, I'm not going to get all of them. Time carried an excellent article. The Daily Papers are carrying excellent articles. The Nixon, the article this morning from the San Jose Mercury, Nixon's lawyer is a paid spy. I take pride in saying that the article that I published that was published in The Realist, that I wrote, and it came out in August, they're available at the Thunderbird here in Carmel, on how Richard Nixon really came to power, was an explanation that Richard Nixon has been an espionage agent since 1945, that he was the selected agent for the Cold War, the front man for the conglomerates. And I have never seen in print any article yet to suggest that outside of believing that he was a Republican, he was more than a Republican. He was an espionage agent placed by certain people who control the Republican Party. And we're getting pretty warm now when the news comes out. That article came out in August of 72. If Nixon's lawyer is paying spies and he is handing out money for espionage or sabotage against the Democratic Party all over the country, because the money that Kalmbach gave to Donald Segretti went all over the United States, and he was only one of 50 other people that were working like him. The boss is a spy, too, and the evidence will unfold for years to come, but you find today in the news this week that the admission that Kalmbach, the attorney for Richard Nixon, was handing out money to Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary for Richard Nixon, who was giving it to Donald Segretti. Now, of course, at this point, Kalmbach is saying he didn't know what the money was used for. $30,000 to $40,000 was given in a particular time period to an espionage agent who used to live here on the Monterey Peninsula. It was in the judge advocate's office in Fort Ord, Donald Segretti. It becomes pretty obvious when they get $10 to $20 million siphoning through Mullen Associates, and then it goes through various different hands and through the Treasury Department. Segretti was paid from the Treasury Department. It becomes very obvious that these men are just handed lumps of sums of money. And in innocence, Kalmbach says, I don't know what he did with it. You can be sure that Nixon's lawyer, who would protect Richard Nixon against any suit of anything illegal or wrong, he represents him as his personal lawyer, would want to know what Donald Segretti is doing with $40,000 or $30,000. And the subject came up because of the Senate investigation of Patrick Gray, whether he should be the head of the FBI. Of course, none of these people were called by Patrick Gray or prosecuted in the federal case that just went through, and they were immune from any questioning, and nothing has been surfaced yet about these people in terms of legal documents. Now these FBI reports are coming out, and Patrick Gray said, we've gone as far as we can go on this public forum. We can't discuss it anymore. At this point, he said, I can't tell you your committee anything else because it borders on the question of national security. Well, L. Patrick Gray isn't kidding about national security. He can't talk to the Senate Judiciary about the Watergate for the same reason that Earl Warren said you can't see in the archives what's locked up about the assassination of John Kennedy. National security is the very last word they have left. That holds the lock over the door. The key can't get into the evidence, because who would be so unpatriotic to want to jeopardize this country by exposing the multiple assassinations and murders and sabotage that's going on in this country? Those doors are locked. But Gray just says it's national security that you can't know any more about what's in my FBI memos, and your staff members can't see it. A few congressmen sit in my office for 8 days, 8 hours a day. We'll let you read some of these papers, but I can't give you any more information. The Senate committee is getting very angry now and said if we don't have John Ehrlichman, we can't have Patrick Gray pass as the head of the FBI. We won't recommend him if we don't get Mr. Ehrlichman to release John Dean, the president's attorney. Now, Nixon's other attorney besides Kalmbach was John Dean, and in every hearing where witnesses were called to investigate the Watergate case, Dean sat there as the attorney for Richard Nixon. So you know who this espionage was for. His personal attorney sat in on all of the questioning of each of these people, and this man was suspect himself. They got wind of every question asked, every witness that was to be called. They controlled the witnesses. They told Segretti, they gave him questions that he would be asked at the grand jury. They told him they would be easy. When you reconstruct the Watergate and break it down into the way the evidence is lining up, it's exactly the way the Warren Commission was run, but everybody accepted it as a truth because the men weren't caught in the act. The excuse they used this week, Patrick Gray used, for not calling Martha Mitchell as a witness was that John wouldn't allow him to. Well, Herbert Kalmbach, Nixon's attorney, was the man allegedly who took Martha Mitchell to a hospital where she had stitches and was treated medically and said that the people who did this to her should be arrested, and she had been seen cops and robbers games. So if Patrick Gray didn't want to know anything about Herbert Kalmbach from the Segretti angle, he should have known about Martha Mitchell, except that he was staying at the same hotel. And that hasn't, the congressmen who are investigating haven't gone into that. I sent a letter to the members of the Senate Judiciary this week reminding them that Patrick Gray was at the same hotel that Fred LaRue and Mardian were. They didn't call in Robert Mardian, the Assistant Attorney General, and the Senate Judiciary wants to know about that. Mardian went with Fred LaRue to the committee to reelect the president and helped destroy all records the Monday after the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel. I think that Patrick Gray is going to have a hard time passing the Senate Judiciary. It would be a terrible day for America if he gets through. And I really urge all of you to use your efforts to write to Senator Tunney. He's on the committee. John McClellan's on the committee. Sam Ervin is on the committee. The Senate Judiciary, and tell them to please keep asking more questions of Patrick Gray about the shooting of Wallace, the bullets at the Maryland Shopping Center, the Martha Mitchell episode out in California. The letters matter. I really feel that I urge you every week to write letters, and I know that they matter in some cases, and when people take an interest, it does make a difference. There was one thing that I asked a few weeks ago about writing the California Supreme Court, the important question of whether people arrested have the right to choose their own attorney, because there's many people in San Quentin that are sitting on what was death row or would be if they brought it back again, who would prove their innocence if they had their own attorney. It's a matter of life and death to them. It's only a letter in your hands. And this week, the California Supreme Court turned down the right of these particular prisoners at the Adjustment Center or any others who want their own attorney. The article in the paper this week, a very small article, it was 2 inches in our paper here in Monterey, but it affects so many lives of people in prison, whether they're going to live or die or ever get out or have a trial. And the Supreme Court ruled 4-2 this Tuesday that in the lower court, they may name any competent lawyer for a criminal defendant, that the defendant does not have a chance to appoint his own lawyer. And they use the example of Fleeta Drumgo, who's up at San Quentin now, who's one of the San Quentin Six, and he wanted a particular lawyer to represent him at the trial that's coming up, Richard Hodge. And the Supreme Court said no, 4-2, he has to use the court-appointed lawyer. That's just like saying you have no chance to prove your innocence. They don't introduce the evidence that would allow these men to prove their innocence. The prosecutor appoints the defender, the defense lawyer. We saw it out in Salinas with the trial of Hugo Pinnell, where the prosecution appoints the defense, and they don't bring any witnesses or evidence in to allow those particular people to prove that they were innocent. And I'm sure that if more people had taken this letter seriously and flooded them with letters to show how much you care about these particular people whose lives are on the line, there would have been a change in the attitude. There was an example of that with the riot down in San Diego, with the race riot on Kitty Hawk. And the NAACP came in on this particular thing and found that a witness had perjured himself at the riots, and there were black men that were put in the hole in the brig and convicted and given stiff sentences. And a particular group of private investigators took it upon themselves to follow. And this is what we have to do. People have to begin doing this. They followed the man who had spoken against a particular witness. Michael Lorry was a white sailor, the principal government witness. And he testified on the stand that he had no racial animosity and that he saw a particular sailor, Cleveland Mallory, punch and kick a white sailor during the riot. So the NAACP hired its own undercover agent, which is what we are going to have to do to survive against this system, is not accept those trials or what they're saying is true. They hired their own undercover agent who became friendly with Michael Lorry, and they took tape recordings of what Michael Lorry said, and he said that he admitted he lied, that he lied on the stand about the blows that he saw Mallory strike, and he stated that if he had a gun, he himself would have shot at least 30 of them blacks, that he hated the blacks, and that he had lied on the stand. So the NAACP took this evidence and said that here was perjury, that the Navy withheld evidence, absolute evidence, that this man had lied. They encouraged him to lie, and they had sent Mallory home with a bad conduct discharge and so forth. Well, after private investigators came in and found this witness, it changed the whole effect of the trial. And the man does not get a bad conduct discharge. And the Navy right away came back and said, we're changing the conviction. It's reversed. And they said, we're wiping out the conviction on this case, but it had nothing to do with your lawsuit. We did it on our own. And that was an untruth. It was only because a few private citizens cared that one particular man did not get the discharge that would blacken his career, that would keep him from doing other things that he wanted to do when he got out, or keep him in the brig longer. It was because some private people cared and got their heads together and found the real truth, that one person's life or many people's lives are changed. I want to talk this week. There was an article by Jack Anderson about the CIA and Alan Dulles and the spy planes on Dirty Tricks. And it's about a book coming out in review. A Mr. Prouty, who used to work with the CIA, is coming out with a book. He was Air Force Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, and he worked with the Pentagon, and he was a support officer for the CIA for 9 years, and he supplied material, and he was in London. And now he's writing a book on the dirty tricks of the CIA, and Jack Anderson refers in his article to one or two of the tricks. But I want to mention that 2 years ago, this May, I came here to the KLRB news department to to do a analysis or discussion of the Pentagon Papers and the meaning of the Pentagon Papers to what is happening in America, and were they significant, the revelation of some truth, the way the government was escalating the war or killing DM. And at the time that I did this broadcast here, I said that the really important disclosure that the country has to face is the assassinations of the president, the senator, the civil rights leaders, and that the Pentagon Papers was a start of one man working within the system, working with the National Security Council, Daniel Ellsberg, who had a conscience, saw that this country was going wrong by lying and deception, and put his life on the line to tell people some truths about this country. And it is a valuable book. People should read it and support him. And they should be giving him support during his trial with letters, which most people fail to do, I know. Well, at the same time I was doing this show on KLRB, and Pentagon Papers were discussed all over the world, Mr. Prouty was interviewed in the British Broadcasting. And Prouty got up in London and said that the only thing that was important in this world was the truth about the assassinations. And as far as I know, in terms of radio work, I hear from other researchers all over, we were the only two people that day that were on the air, one in Carmel, one in London, talking about the political assassinations as being the real truth to be divulged, and that the Pentagon Papers was a stepping stone in preparation for what would really come down someday. Well, Prouty is a member of the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, along with me. I'm a member of that group to find out who, we know who's committing these conspiracies, but we want the Washington public officials to expose them. And the Committee to Investigate Assassinations is in Washington, D.C., run by Bernard Fensterwald. And Prouty is a member of that particular group. And when the Watergate arrest broke in June, I was called Washington to speak to Bud Fensterwald, and I spoke to Prouty that day. He was having lunch with Prouty that day, and I said, I think this is our team. This is the same team. I recognize the names. Well, you see, Prouty knows more about the CIA than I do, but we both know about the John Kennedy assassination. So one of the revelations that Jack Anderson has from Prouty's book is that in 1959, one of the CIA chief Alan Dulles' spy planes allegedly flew down over Russia. The crew was questioned by Soviet intelligence and returned quietly to the United States, where they were debriefed by others, among others was James McCord, a former CIA man convicted in the Watergate scandal. So Prouty recognized that name immediately from his CIA work and the debriefing at the time. But from my research, I knew that Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union in 1959 as an intelligence agent and was partly responsible for bringing down, with radar techniques testing, these U-2 flights over the Soviet Union. Gary Powers mentions them in his book, as a matter of fact. That was Oswald's role as an agent of Alan Dulles' CIA. So you have the whole cycle, James McCord, Alan Dulles, and Lee Harvey Oswald, the spy planes. There's a whole milieu in the years of 59, 60 to 63, and on up to the Watergate that we're working together. And Prouty will bring out some of this in his book. His book is on the Dirty Tricks Department of the Central Intelligence Agency, written by a man who was a part or knew it. Now, the CIA can't stop his book. The book is called The Secret Team. They tried to stop Victor Marchetti's book, and they did temporarily, on the basis that Marchetti was an employee of the team of the CIA and therefore couldn't reveal the dirty tricks. But evidently, there's a technicality in Prouty that he was an advisor over in England and wasn't on the books as an employee. He had a different label so he could get away with what he's doing without being arrested, or they can't stop the book. The book is going through and it'll be out very shortly. About a week or two ago, we did a thing on natural disasters. I talk a lot about martial law because when we talk about the Watergate team, that was the group that would instigate martial law, but because of members of the team being arrested at the Watergate Hotel, there's another alternate plan, I'm convinced, for taking over control of the United States, and it will be at a time of emergency, which has to do with the two-way radio into your home and the TV and the booklets we talked about at length on another program. Well, this week, for those of you who listened to that, there was an article that the Bay Area is warned of potential disasters from tidal waves. Now, there's a book that I've recommended many, many times called Project Paperclip by Clarence Lasby on how the space scientists would cause certain natural disasters to take place to bring drought to one group and water to another to control through the space satellites the climate and the weather in order to control the people or the vegetation. You starve a few, you feed a few, you move the clouds and the weather, the climate, to protect the people that you want, and you eliminate the others by bringing drought and natural disasters. And the warning, the big controls, we talk about these two-way radios to protect us, the public relations firms sell you like they did in Nazi Germany. All this is for your own good. So when I read in the Chronicle this week that the Bay Area is warned of potential disasters from tidal waves that come every 200 years that could wipe out all of San Francisco, and they watch about, tell about future earthquakes and tidal waves, I have to read where the study is done. Is it done by government-connected people? Who is going to predict these tidal waves that I'm predicting are bound to happen, or some typical form of disaster? So it turns out that from Menlo Park, where a lot of studies are done for our government on these particular things, this evacuating warning system is being built up. And it's done by the environment study conducted by the U.S. Interior Department and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. They are warning us about these huge tidal waves are going to happen, and the United States government, the same departments, would have you all wired for sound, two-way, for the big tidal wave or earthquake that's going to come. This fits in with natural disasters. Watch for these predictions and things, and then when they come, they can say, see, we just predicted this. There it is. I'm very suspicious of the, after reading Project Paperclip, that we're going to have a flood of natural disasters. And speaking of natural disasters and some that aren't so natural, we're going to jump onto the airplane evidence, because the news is flooding, and when you talk about accidents and disasters and airplane crashes and planes without pilots, every week new information comes in on things that I'm suspecting, like the airplane crash in Miami at Christmas, the one over Chicago where the Mrs. Hunt was on. She's the wife of the Watergate Howard Hunt. This week, there was news about some new plane crashes. The plane crash that went down December the 8th over Chicago, the one that Mrs. Hunt was on. An article this week came out. William Lamb from the safety inspector from the National Transportation Board said the last words of the pilot he possibly ushered were, "I'm sorry." Now, this was April the 8th, and he's saying, "I'm sorry." March the 1st, they find out he's sorry. I have classified, when I did my research for 8 years on just the testimony before the Warren Commission, there was evidence some destroyed, some delayed, some evidence is altered, some is missing. But under delayed is the kind of thing where they go through every possession of Lee Harvey Oswald's in a garage and take it out and make an inventory. But then when they find a camera with some film later and they have to attribute it to him, they go back in the garage and they say, oh, this was there, we didn't see it. Even though the FBI says, no, it couldn't be there, we went through every box, they say, oh, yeah, that was there. And that's delayed evidence. Evidence comes in to fit the facts later, and that's all it is. It's simply delayed. They can bring it in from anywhere. It's like with the ITT memo that came up. Dita Baird admitted that she signed the memo. It was hers, and the White House didn't like that, so they get Intertel in, and they go out to Dita Baird, and 3 weeks later she says, no, I didn't sign that. That was planted on me. That, if I had 20 in help working every day, we could really get this system down beautifully and cross-file. I used to have a lot of help before, and I don't have now. And these things should really be systematically put into their proper place, because this is delayed evidence coming in that she said, I'm sorry. The pilot says, I'm sorry. Now, the article was in the Washington Post and goes on to mention that the people killed in the plane were Chicago Congressman George Collins, a Democrat, and Michelle Clark, a CBS correspondent. They don't even mention Mrs. Hunt's name in the article now at this point, when his name is in the news almost every day in connection with Donald Segretti and the Watergate. Now, the Miami plane crash this week, March the 6th, there's a little article that the throttle may have caused problems. First we heard there were some birds in the jet pilot. Now there's an unexplained throttle noise. The article came in this week. The Eastern Airline jumbo jet apparently had a series of unexplained problems. Watch for the apparently's, the probably's. They could have happened. They're still trying to explain the Miami plane, and I think those three planes crashed at one time, and the Alameda one up north, as test cases to see what to hide, first of all, the Chicago crash, which was the important one, and to make these planes uncertain for something future when they want another person on these planes. It sounds a little paranoid to just throw these things out to you, but I have followed them very carefully. I once did a show at the time that the buildings burned down at Fort Ord, the theaters, and it was the same week that Terry Magnin was talking in front of the congressional committees about violence and provocateurs at Seaside, and it was the day before Westmoreland was supposed to visit Fort Ord. And I felt that the timing of their visit and the way those theaters were set up, that there were provocateurs. And there's somebody floating around the Big Sur area now who is telling people that he knows who did it or was part of it, that he was a provocateur. I don't close those cases until the files are really sure, and I watch all the evidence come in when I think they're setups. When people want to give certain testimony or effect a change, these things happen just at that time, and it's just too convenient, and the investigation of the cases is always left hanging, and you can't really find who did them. Richard Nixon made an appointment this week of Alexander Butterfield to be the head of the Federal Aviation Administration. And he got caught because Mr. Butterfield was still an Air Force commission. He wasn't discharged from the Air Force. This is a problem when you're talking about a military takeover in the United States, and you see the Pentagon running every single thing. The man who's in the Air Force will decide what are airplane crashes, how many, you know, he will help as the head of the FAA, but he is a military man. Well, he got caught because he was supposed to resign from the military one day before he became the head of the Air Force. So he had to back out. Richard Nixon had to back out on the appointment of Alexander Butterfield till he decides to resign from the Air Force because he can't be both. That's very considerate of him, but it's just paperwork one way or the other. It's paperwork. Now, I'm talking about evidence that's delayed and evidence that is confusing and not certain, and I'm going to talk about evidence altered because this is the most outrageous part of political assassinations is the way, the flagrant way that the information is destroyed that would prove the particular people are selected patsies and that the domestic intelligence is committing these particular crimes. In our own area, in Santa Cruz, this week, there was an article about a boy whose brother was killed up in Felton. He's one of those boys of the four who was killed at the campsite. And he said, and Jeffrey Card said, when you killed my brother, whoever did it, you also killed a dream. So Jeffrey went up to the house where the boys lived that was broken into when they were killed. Four boys were camping. They weren't hurting anybody. And he went up to the area, and he went with somebody else. And I'm going to read you a quote of this article because it pertains to the massacres in Santa Cruz now and the one that happened in the Oda family just a little while ago. This brother said he went up to the place where the campsite had been, and he said that a crew of youngsters, watched it, of the youth conservation camp had torn down both the house and another across the canyon where some people had lived for a while. That, you know what it looks like now? Like nothing had ever been there. They buried a lot of stuff. They burned all the wood. They scattered the leaves and branches around, so the last time I missed it entirely and had to double back and find it. Now, for those of you who live in the Santa Cruz area, the youth conservation camp, do your own research. People call me and they do their own investigations, just like the NAACP did about the Kitty Hawk riot. Do your own research. Find out what age group those youngsters were, because I'm going to talk about youngsters in it with the Stennis shooting. Who gave the orders to destroy that evidence? That case hasn't even gone to court. Why was the wood burned? Why was the shack burned down? You see, in the John Kennedy assassination, after I cross-filed all that evidence for 8 years, I came to the conclusion that if you broke that entire assassination down from the handling of the evidence to the commission hearings of how they investigated it, you could get the entire espionage arrangement, domestic violence or international violence, the way the CIA and the Pentagon conducts espionage across this country. And it is a formula that works in every one of these cases, every single one of these conspiracy cases. No evidence is available. Now, this house was burned down, so those in the Santa Cruz area who do not trust the officials, the investigating officials up there, I hear over and over again, and I believe every word of it. And I know it for a fact because I've called them at the time of the audit, OTA trial. They do not look at the evidence or get the proper witnesses. Look who had the cabin across the way from those where those boys look. Those are little research you can do this week. Who had the lookout cabin where those four boys looked that was also burned down? There was a lookout cabin that knew their pattern across the canyon. Find out who lived there, where they came from, what state, what kind of a car they had, and see if you can connect. Some of you up there can get your heads together now and see who rented there, who saw them. Get the description from the neighborhood or the people camping. The lookout cabin of those four boys. And then go to the youth conservation camp or ask the Santa Cruz public officials who gave the orders to destroy that. You see, I always said if you knew one thing, you'd be on the way solving who killed John Kennedy. Who gave the orders to take John Kennedy's car to Dearborn, Michigan, 2 days after his murder and destroy it totally on the inside without counting the bullets, the bullet direction? We've talked about this so many times on this show. You could tell how far the gunman stood by the way the bullets go in. You could tell the location of the crossfires by where the bullets were found. You could tell how many bullets went off by examining the car. A lot could be told by the evidence, and somebody had to go in. Now, the Youth Conservation is a state organization having to do with the penal system in some way. So find out who gave the orders to destroy that. There should be a law against somebody in the whatever department, the district attorney's office, the sheriff, the police department, whoever touches any evidence, once a crime is committed, should be getting a fine and 10 years in jail. The person who orders it destroyed. Not the person who goes in, not the kids, but the one who orders it destroyed. Now, in the paper today, there's a little article in the San Jose Mercury. You wouldn't believe it. Frazier evidence burned up. Now, I said all along that John Frazier was a patsy for the same people. The Oda family was not killed by John Frazier. I do not believe it. I believe he may have had a part. He may have been a lookout down at the gate. He's a patsy for something very big in the Santa Cruz area. And I have said this on shows. I've done shows on the Oda family on the radio here. Here's your article today. District Attorney Peter Chang was cleaning out the evidence locker at his office Wednesday of what appeared to be materials from John Frazier's murder trial 18 months ago. Asked if the cleaning out of evidence in the case was a result of an appeal by Frazier having been turned down by the Supreme Court, Chang replied the evidence being destroyed that was destroyed were things not used in the trial. He said he received no word yet of a decision on Frazier's appeal. Now, here is the point. Frazier appeals to the Supreme Court, I want another trial. And if he had another trial, and if the evidence were available, Frazier would not be convicted. Sirhan asked for a trial that was turned down by the United States Supreme Court last week, 7-0. New evidence that he did not kill Robert Kennedy. The gun that was used, that Sirhan allegedly used, was thrown away the night after Robert Kennedy was killed, or the same night. I can't even remember which. I have all the information at home. It was thrown away by the Los Angeles Police Department. You see, in Dealey Plaza, John Kennedy's car was destroyed. A lamppost was removed. A sign was removed. The clothing of John Connolly was sent, the dry cleaner, so you couldn't tell whether the bullets were entry or exit. When the doctors who operated on him said the bullets couldn't have come from the direction you say, just bring the clothing. Then the FBI said, well, the clothing was dry cleaned. By the time it gets to the FBI, it's laundered and dry cleaned. Okay, the Frazier evidence is all destroyed. I could mention, you know, 100, 120 cases of this, of lesser known people who have appealed whose evidence is destroyed. But when these well-known cases are happening so flagrantly, it seems to me that people in that community should ask for the removal of Peter Chang and the entire law enforcement until the truth comes out. There are enough living people, if they're not afraid of their life, to attest to a multiple group of people involved in the OTA trial. And it really makes me angry that this week not only is all the evidence done to show who could have killed those four boys, but now the evidence is gone with the Frazier, and a lot of people are linking the murders up there to the OTA murder to the massacres that are taking place up in Santa Cruz right now. And it's more than speculation. I had called a lot of public officials at the time of the OTA trial. One was a Mr. Jackson, who's now handling the Mullen boy. The same public officials that were handling Frazier are handling Mullen. And he'll get the same isolation, the same railroading, and all the evidence here that proved conspiracy up in the Santa Cruz area is being destroyed like it was with Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy, and I think it's terrible. Now, they say a youth conservation group, it says a group of young people, a crew of youngsters. Get that, youngsters? Okay, here's, getting really mad this week. There's so much news we can't even touch it, but we're going into the Stennis shooting in Washington, D.C. A group of youngsters, when the congressman was shot, Senator John Stennis was shot, and the FBI said, we can't find who did it. Now, the FBI gets in on the case. The local police don't handle the evidence. It's not good enough for them. They might find something. But the FBI, that's a clue of a conspiracy, gets in on it. There's a little law called the Anti-Assassination Act. So any public official that is shot at, the FBI gets in. Well, then they just sweep up all the evidence. So if they plan these things and sweep it up, there's nothing left for the local policeman. I'm not anti-police. I'm not anti-police force or anti-sheriff, but these special tax squads work as a chain, and they sweep up all your little goodies. So John Stennis was shot. He was coming home, and the article in the paper last week, dated February 27, said they gave up looking for the person who shot him. The FBI was pessimistic, the Washington police, and the headline, the lead article says $70,000 posted for two, in quotes, punks. Now, it goes on to say, in their search for the person who attacked John Stennis, they were looking for two black males, 16 to 18 years old, Stennis says, who took their money and said, now we're going to shoot you anyway. The police summed it up this way. I guess they were just a couple of roving young punks, probably riding around town in a stolen car, and they were scared to death when they found out it was a senator. So you have your young men up at the conservation camp, you know, turning the adults against the youth again, the permissive society. You have the black here, the young punks, turning against John Stennis. You see, they have no evidence at all except this fact. And then they say, and there's your probablys and your stolen car, right? Well, there's an article that followed 3 days later because Mr. Stennis is getting a little better now. See, Senator Stennis is on the road to recovery. And he still describes two black males who said, we're going to shoot you anyway. But he's getting a little better. But now he's a little more sure of the evidence. And they're a little bit older. And he describes men much older and taller. Now what are they? A few days ago, Senator Stennis provided an additional description of the men who shot him. They were in their 20s or 30s. And they were 6 feet tall, weighed 190 to 195 pounds, with close-cropped hair. Now, this is a little different than those little skinny 14-year-olds running around, I should think. They could be 30 and they're 195 pounds. That's hardly young punks. That's a full-grown man. 5 feet eight, he thinks they were now. 5 feet eight, 195 or 6 feet tall, the article says. They could be more than 6 feet tall, 20 to 30 years old, and 195 pounds. So you've got a range now where they've grown a lot, and they've gained a lot, and they've put on about 14 years, see, because he's now his recall is coming better. Well, I got a bulletin here from Wilf. It's a legislative bulletin dated February the 16th, which is an interesting bulletin, just prior to the time that this came out, at the time that Senator John Stennis was shot. I'm reading it directly. This is, quote, "The Senate Democratic Caucus this year demanded that all presidential nominees promise to testify before the Senate committee whenever requested as a condition for confirmation. And that includes Roy Ash and Weinberger and the whole team that are running our budget." It says, I go back to the quote, "The caucus approved 35-1 the resolution that was introduced by Senator John Stennis of Mississippi and Senator Jared Nelson of Wisconsin to strictly limit the use of executive privilege." I'll continue, then I'll comment. "The resolution requires any executive branch witness summoned to testify to appear and answer questions. He can only refuse to answer the question if he obtained a letter from the president invoking executive privilege. And if the committee decided that the plea was not well taken, it could still direct the witness to answer. Further refusal would be referred to the full Senate for possible Senate action. A special committee was established to draft guidelines in testimony from the president's advisors. Stennis, who's now in serious condition in a hospital after being shot by a robber, and so forth, wanted to take the resolution into the Senate rules. No similar action has been taken in the House." Now, we don't know how far this got when John Stennis was shot, because if you try to kill a man who clips Richard Nixon's wings or Roy Ash's wings or Caspar Weinberger's, all of our budget, our OEO, our welfare, child care center, you name it, it's all under the White House roof, what they do, how they spend their money, whether they want to give $22 billion to North and South Vietnam and nothing at home, they decide. So John Stennis wanted them to account. They've taken everything from Congress they can. They're just sitting there doing nothing. All he's asking is that we please answer some questions for us instead of saying immunity. John Stennis was shot, and they try to cover. That's a cover story. Two young punks, probably in a car. I'm moving along fast, I know, but I think you can get it all. The cover story is so pat, no conspiracy, just a little guy's on a little robbery, a couple of kids on a spree. Oh my, they found a congressman, we better kill him. It wasn't that old. It was two big hunks, 30 years old, 195 pounds, 6 feet tall, who knew just exactly who they were going to get, and they didn't want his money. They didn't walk up and say, "I'm going to kill you." They said, "Give me your money," and when he gave them their money, they said, "Now we're going to kill you," and they left. So then the little conspiracy law comes in, and you bet anything they're not going to find those punks, because they have gone out of this country somewhere, and they have rewarded. They have stopped the whatever was happening on the Senate floor, and I hope the other senators have the courage or follow through that the White House does not have immunity for everything that's happening. The Oaks trial came up in Santa Rosa, the killing of the man who left the Indian group over at Alcatraz. He was murdered in cold blood, and they tried to get away with that. The men who murdered him were let out. It was supposed to be involuntary manslaughter. And the testimony came out this week. The judge, it's too late to change the charges, but the district attorney has now admitted that what happened up in that Santa Rosa area, that these men were told it's open season on coons and Indians. That means if you get them, it doesn't matter. Well, I know it's been open season on hippies and campers and kids out, like those boys up in Santa Cruz or the girls hitchhiking. It's open season. And anyone, any employee or person who works for the investigative agencies who wants to spread terror in the community and turn around the fear against the young people, he can go ahead and do it. And the same thing with Mr. Oaks. They tried to kill him in a bar in San Francisco, the leader of the Indian group. He was an activist, one of the most outspoken, Richard Oaks, and he was hit on the head and unconscious in a coma for a long, long time and recovered to go up to Santa Rosa and be killed because it was open season on the Indians and coons. Larry Shears, I just have about three more minutes. Larry Shears is an agent provocateur who worked for the Treasury Department, the Department of Narcotics, who broke the plot to kill Cesar Chavez last year, and his life has been in danger ever since. He exposed the plan of the Treasury Department and several agents to kill Cesar Chavez. Larry Shears has been running, and you can believe he's running. If he's paid from the Treasury Department and Segretti and the whole team of espionage men that we know, Nixon's lawyers and those groups, fund through the Treasury Department, and this is what I said was happening even long before the Watergate, Larry Shears better run for his life. Well, he's been in constant danger for his life, and he's been carrying a gun because there's been so many threats upon his life. And, you know, they want to know the context that he has and the information because he revealed also the plan to kill Eldridge Cleaver. Well, he's put in jail for 60 days for carrying a concealed weapon. If he gets threats on his life and he isn't armed, he's going to be just killed like Oakes, who wasn't carrying a gun. And if he carries a gun, he's put in jail for having the weapon. If you expose the system, you end up dead or in jail or running away, and you don't have very much protection. There's just a brief mention, I don't want you to miss it, in Newsweek, it was the March the 5th, and you might have missed it, the Charles Colson story of the espionage squad in the White House and Howard Hunt and the discussion that they had of bugging George McGovern's campaign and Senator Muskie's, and the conversation is, let's plant a woman in a sensitive secretarial job in Muskie's campaign, and we'll get a web, we'll get a right girl for the job. Mary Kopechne was the girl planted in Ted Kennedy's campaign, and when they wanted to discredit him for 1972, she had to be murdered. One life, a little bit more or less, doesn't matter, and in the article, The Realist, I just barely mentioned eliminating Ted Kennedy by a group of espionage squad people who want to remove him, and the best way to do it was to have the dead chick in the car. If you killed the third Kennedy, you would remove him, but it would become too obvious, and then there are enough Democrats that might have gotten mad. They're not so loyal to life, per se, that Mary Kopechne mattered. They just keep on pushing their candidate and call him a governor and say, well, you'll be the front man this time while Ted sits this one out, and that's all he was. Well, time is running out. I could do about 4 hours on the news this week. As I said, the news is pretty hot this week, but we'll cool off and we'll see what brings next week, okay?
Thank you very much, May. May Bristol will be back with us next Thursday at 5:15. This is KLRB FM Carmel. Cool.